Lecture 15, Cantos 1 and 2 of Purgatorio, Typology and Poetry.
This third lecture, dedicated to the work of Dante as it reflects the scripture, centers on the first two cantos of the Purgatory. They are the introduction to a decidedly new place. We, as readers of the poem, have gotten accustomed to Inferno. We tend to like it. It's the part of the poem that's most read for some fairly obvious reasons. And we tend to think of Dante as the author of the Inferno. If you hear people speak Dante, if they give the name of what he wrote, I would say that 8 out of 10 times the word you hear next is Inferno, Dante's Inferno, or Hell. The Purgatory also needs, for people who have not read it before, a quick clarification. Purgatory is frequently used in the vernacular as being more or less the same thing as hell. People speak of being in purgatory as a place of punishment, and as though it were a final destination, and as though all one was going to have was grief. That is not so. At least it's not so in Dante's universe. Purgatory is a place, while it is where one suffers one's past sin, it is a place that is joyful. It is the first stage of God's heaven. And it's important to know that when one begins, or when one hears a discussion of purgatory. It's the beginning of bliss. And the very beginning of the purgatory is a place of some considerable bliss. We've spent time in hell, a place where we have the light of the moon, not the light of the sun, darkness, suffering, eternal pain. And here we come to a space which is liberated, which is free, which is marked by time moving, by the sun rising, by change. It is the most earthly part of Dante's comedy, and some people think the most beautiful part of Dante's comedy. The opening, thus, of the Purgatory itself grants us a peace and joy that we've not had in the poem, and is really strikingly different from anything that we've had in the Inferno. It's also, we realize, a new poem in another way. The guide in it will remain Virgil. It's strange to find Virgil, who doesn't know this place, acting as a guide in it. There'll be more about that in a moment. But it is poetically a place where Dante has not got an antecedent. There are various descriptions of purgatory that Dante probably knew and probably drew upon. Yet, in terms of a major poetic treatment, there is nothing before him. This leaves him at a disadvantage. He has nothing to borrow from that is distinguished, and at an enormous advantage. He's free now. He's not tied to Virgil. And Virgil is going to behave, and it'll be a sub-theme of this lecture, as an at times barely needed appendage. In this poem, which is governed by the rules of Christianity, in this poem in which Virgil, in major ways, need not apply. The three major aspects of the opening two cantos, which are a unit, as are all the opening two cantos of each cantica in Dante, they make a global unit, very carefully measured, one with another, usually placed in parallel, canto one with elements in canto two. In the case of this first two cantos of the Purgatory, I want to speak about Cato of Utica, who appears astoundingly as the presiding spirit, not only of the first two cantos, but of all of Purgatory. Second, I wish to discuss the pattern of the Exodus, as it is essential to the meaning of this part of the poem, and I would argue, in the wake of others before me, to a meaning of the whole poem. And third, I want to take up a very local matter, the last thing that happens in canto two, when Cato of Utica, who has ostensibly disappeared from the poem and ostensibly has no more function in it, suddenly reappears and rounds upon Dante and the other saved souls whom he encounters there, and chews them out for their taking pleasure in a song written by Dante. And I want to ask the question, is this song, as it's presented in the text, which seems so beautiful and so very appealing, is it blameworthy or praiseworthy? The title of the lecture is Purgatory 1 and 2, Typology and Poetry. And I need very quickly to say what typology is, asking pardon of those who know perfectly well what it is. I'm aware that not everyone who will hear these words is fully conversant with theories of Christian exegesis. By typology, I mean simply, and it's not that simple, but the interpretation of biblical relations as it was first exploited by such writers as St. Augustine and John Cassian in the 4th and 5th centuries, in which the Old Testament is understood as revealing the future, as it will be known and now has been known in the Gospels, primarily in the Gospels, in the life of Christ. How things, events, personages in the Old Testament foreshadow, foretell, are types of, that's where we get our word typology, are types of latter events that we have come to know. For instance, one says Moses is a type of Christ. Or the Exodus becomes referred to as is made exegetically clear by the coming of Christ, and he is then referred to as Christ our Exodus. As Moses led the Israelites out of the desert, so Christ leads us out of the desert of temptation and toward salvation. Something like that. And I hope that's clear enough. In this method of exegesis, which is the cornerstone of the Christian understanding of the Old Testament, without which probably the Old Testament would have been discarded, as some early Christians argued, that we no longer needed the old law, we had the new. And there were bitter battles at various church councils in which some very strong things were said against the Old Testament. The wiser decision, which isn't always true, was triumphant, and we have as the Christian Bible, the Hebrew Bible, as its absolute necessary cornerstone, the basis and ground for its own method of exegesis. What is most important in that method of exegesis is history. What Christianity has that, for instance, Platonism does not have is a grounding in history. History is where important things happen. History is where things are determined. History is where referentiality takes us, not to ideas, but to ideas in things, events, and people. I don't know how often we think about that, if we think about the force of Christianity in the West, and yet it seems, insofar as the civilization made a choice between Plato and Christ, one of the things that it was choosing is history. Certainly that is true for Dante. He has chosen history as it were, the muse of his poem. It is the ground on which his poem occurs. Even though it occurs in the other world, it is continually related to this world and to history in this world. Now, that being true, insofar as it is true, I can give you an example of how historically minded Dante is and how free he is in making things work out the way he wants them to. The date as we enter the first canto of the Purgatory, because Dante knows about time at the Antipodes and moving to 12 hours earlier, the date in Inferno when you come to the bottom of the pit of hell is Saturday night of Easter weekend. It is now, because you come up at the other side of the world, where the mountain of Purgatory is, it's 12 hours later, and it is dawn of Easter Sunday. Everything works out perfectly for Dante. What better time to enter Purgatory, see the Mount of Purgatory and be at the shore of Purgatory than the dawn of Easter Sunday? Now, it's the dawn of Easter Sunday in the year 1300. That's the imaginary date of the vision. A very nice date, a 100-year round number. A very important year. It's the year in which Boniface VIII proclaimed the first really major jubilee, and an enormous pack of people descended upon Rome. So a major year in the history of the Church. All 100 years have, as we know even today, as we approach the year 2000, have a kind of impact on us. They have a signature of importance about them. And so here we are in Easter, 1300. And what is the date within the poem? Dante does a really terrible thing to us. He establishes the date, and I won't go into the evidence for this, but he gives a very clear indication that the date is both the opening date of the poem, the Friday, the Good Friday on which the poem begins, is the 25th of March, poem actually begins Thursday evening, the 24th of March, 1300, if you want to be technical. The action of the poem begins on the 25th of March in the year 1300. Now, the 25th of March is a terrific day for lots of reasons. The earth, the world was created on the 25th of March. Mary, the Annunciation occurs on the 25th of March. She is impregnated by the Holy Spirit, as it were, on the 25th of March. There are lots of reasons you want to begin a poem on the 25th of March. The only problem with it is that in the year 1300, the Easter weekend was 2 weeks later. And so Dante also clearly says in another passage that this is the anniversary of Good Friday. So you have two dates working in the poem. And they're both there. You can find them both and find perfectly good evidence for both. What has happened historically in Dante criticism is that one set of commentators say it's, you know, the 25th of March, another say it's the 8th of April, and they argue, well, no, wrong, both are right, or both are wrong. Dante is quite wrong to have done it this way, but we're reading Dante, and Dante makes things work out. A French scholar pointed out that it's even worse than that, that the year from the star charts, which Dante had access to, according to him, the star charts, which correspond to the star data we get in the poem, are really from 1301. So this man has, his name is Poole, has even gone to argue that that's the real data in the poem. It's 13. No, I disagree with him. His discovery is quite a wonderful discovery. Dante had this access, he thinks, to an almanac, which happened to have began with 1301. So was Dante going to cast all those star charts for himself? Who'll notice? It took until Emmanuel Poole noticed it in the 20th century for anyone to notice. So you have a poem that dates itself historically, and yet with this kind of voluntarism, which is typical of Dante. If things would work out better that way, make them work out that way. He has it every way. As the more you read him, the more you see that that's what he's doing. We are at the Antipodes. We are at the foot of the Mount of Purgatory, the seven-storied mountain. Right above its foot, it has two areas for anti-purgatory, a total invention of Dante's, a place of waiting and further purification for those who have been saved and are now on their way to their purgation. Purgation is hard work. There's not a moment of it that goes by without the painful memory of the sin that one has committed. One may have committed all seven mortal sins, been forgiven them all, and have to spend hard time on all of the terraces of the mountain. Or one may have committed only one or two of them and simply walk up through the other terraces until one has to put in one's time wherever one was most guilty. And at the top, as you know, at the top of the mountain is Eden. It is not a picture book version of Eden as Dante presents it. It is the actual Eden. That historical grounding for the poem is present every time we look closely at it. And some of the early commentators say, of course, this isn't really Eden. This is an allegory. No, it is not an allegorical representation of the state of human felicity. It's Eden. It's difficult for us to believe it, but within the world of the poem, it is true. The action that we're going to examine begins with the presence, striking and strange presence of Cato, who shouldn't be here by almost everybody's light, who serves as the guardian not only of the place of arrival, but of the entire mountain. That's made clear in the text. And in the second part of this proemial first two canto unit, we have the angel ship arriving, guided by a celestial helmsman with souls in it, singing the song of the Exodus, the 113th Psalm. And then a meeting between one member of that newly arrived saved bunch of souls, a former friend of Dante's from Florence, an instrument maker named Casella, and their failed embrace. Casella then responds to Dante's request and sings a song that Dante wrote. And everything is going along very beautifully. It's very moving, very touching, very amusing. And then suddenly Cato reappears at the end of Canto 2 and chews them out for what they're doing. And I want to end with consideration of why that scene is included. There's another striking dimension to purgatory, which I want to mention. It'll be a sub-theme of the remarks that follow. That is, Virgil is out of his depth here. He can only function as a guide with respect to moral instruction. He never knew theology. He always had to defer on questions of theology. He's not revealed. He knows about Christ because he's seen Christ harrow hell. And he's learned a lot. He even can cite scripture, and he does that in the Inferno. But he's out of his depth theologically. He's wonderful on questions of morality. And in hell, he had expertise of the place. He was geographically correct. Now he is geographically incorrect as well. This is a diminution in Virgil as a potent guide figure. He has to ask people how things are here. And it's a little bit disconcerting for Dante that his guide has to stop and ask people who are already there how things operate in this sphere. There's a tiny little example of it, which has not been much noticed in the commentaries. And by the way, there's a lot of avoidance behavior in the commentaries about Virgil's lack of capacity. So little details that Dante notches the poem with are just gone past. People don't want to talk about them because they're a little embarrassing for Virgil. I'll give you one. In Purgatory 3, Dante and Virgil are trying to figure out how we go up the mountainside. And Virgil doesn't know. He's never been here. It's a sheer cliff. There's going to turn out to be a pathway to it. Virgil, because in hell they went to the left, starts in purgatory leading Dante to the left. It makes sense. You go that way. But he forgot. You turned around when you crawled up the shanks of Satan. And now if you want to continue in the same direction even, you would go right in order to go the same direction that was left going down in the Inferno. It's difficult to do the spatial relations. But now you're going the other way. And so if you wanted to continue your journey in the same direction, you would go to the right. Reason should have figured that out. Furthermore, given the badness of left-handedness and the goodness of right-handedness in Christian and in other cultures, left-handed people have always had the short end of the stick, haven't they? That you would know, you know, you're in God's kingdom, you don't go to the left anymore. In God's kingdom, you go to the right. So that I would argue that some of us would have figured this out. Virgil, rather dramatically, doesn't figure it out. And in trying to figure it out, what he does is typically Virgilian and rationalizing. He tries to figure it out. He doesn't try to look. So he is walking along looking down, and Dante's walking along looking up, and he sees these people who are saved who are saying, go the other way. They say, making sign with the backs of their hands. I never understood what that meant until I was in Tuscany one day and I saw somebody on the street going like this. We go like this in America, but in Tuscany they go like this. Go back, go back. And they've gone the wrong way. Virgil hasn't figured out. And we notice, if we think about the scene, it wasn't Virgil, the guide, who figured out what was going on. It was Dante. He said, hey, look, there's some people up there. Virgil didn't notice them. Dante did. Dante is acting more rationally, in a sense, than Virgil is. Virgil is caught in his rationality and unable to use it because he hasn't got the sentiment or the experience of grace. There's a chilling moment of this which gets talked about a little, but only recently. The opening simile to the sixth canto of the Purgatory is quite extraordinary. It has Dante, who is being pressed by the souls in pre-penitence in the antepurgatory, who want him to recognize them. So when he goes back to the earth, he can tell their relatives that they're alive. That is, they're saved. And if the relatives will pray, they will have to spend less, pray for them, they will have to spend less time in antepurgatory. So there's a real payoff to this poem. If you get recognized by Dante, then maybe you will have to spend less time in antepurgatory. It's a wonderful invention. And he begins the sixth canto with a very nice simile in which he compares himself to the winner at a game of dice who, having concluded the game, walking off with his winnings, is walking along and everybody's following him and reaching out. And only when he reaches back, and what it means when he gives a tip, it's sort of like going to Las Vegas and winning at blackjack and leaving something for the dealer. I've never done that. But I mean, I have played blackjack, but I've never won. And thus, no dealer has gotten wealthy off me. I'm not Dante. And so it's that. It's giving the tip, you know, the winner paying back his winnings to the crowd. Embedded at the beginning of the simile is the other figure. The loser remains behind and sadly recounts the throws. What is astounding to me, until a relatively few years ago, no one had looked at that passage and said, the loser in the simile must also have a referent in the text of the poem. And of course, that referent is, who is the loser? It's Virgil. Virgil, whom we've seen in the third canto of the poem, thinking of himself as loser, as having been unable to use reason to solve the great message, the only thing that's going to save him, faith. That's what he lacks. He knows it. He confesses it. But he couldn't reason his way to faith. Therein lies his failure. And when he thinks about that, he thinks of Plato, Aristotle, of Plato, and of many others. And here he lowered his brow, he put his forehead down, and remained disturbed. The rhyme words are Plato for Plato, turbato, disturbed. That image of Virgil, disturbed by the failure of his reason to find faith, linked with Plato, interestingly enough, the image of how he has failed, how he has become a loser. And that is exactly what he's contemplating now. Here I am guiding this Christian, and everybody wants him because he can give them something, because he believed and they believed, and he can shorten their time here. I have nothing. I have nothing to do here. I am superfluous in this place. Now, that Virgilian, that undercutting of Virgil through the first six cantos of the Purgatory is really very tangible, but that's all I want to say about it. I will come back to one example of it in a few moments. Cato of Utica has no business in this poem, except if you're Dante Alighieri, then he does. The outcry against Cato's presence here among the saved is pronounced and comes from the very beginning of the commentary tradition and lasts into our own day. People are enormously uncomfortable with him. Everything is wrong with him. He is, first of all, he's a pagan. He's not a Christian. What's he doing in purgatory? Second, he's a suicide. He committed suicide in the war against Julius Caesar, as related in Lucan's Pharsalia, or Concerning the Civil War, the more likely actual title of it. We don't have the title. This is a major unfinished epic from the time right after Virgil, along with the Epic of Statius, works that Dante knew extremely well and read extremely closely. We don't have very much contact with them in our part of the 20th century, but they're extremely important for Dante. In the ninth book of Lucan's Concerning the Civil War, Cato gets a treatment which is absolutely noteworthy, and indeed, if one were to speak uncautiously, one would argue that Lucan, who wrote late enough to have had the experience, that Lucan had heard about what the Christians were saying. That is, it's really the closest thing to a Christian text that a pagan has written, at least in my opinion it is. It says things about Cato that are quite extraordinary and may help account for Dante's thinking he can take Cato and transport him into this Christian realm, where he is a true leader, someone who has something real to say, unlike Virgil, and where he is going to have a relation to Dante that is striking in its similarity. And I think that's the further reason Dante sees himself as the offspring of Cato, in a way. Not of Virgil here, but of Cato. And that's been that's a shift for us. He is, because he is so troubling, he's a suicide, he's a pagan, he's a revolutionary, he fought against Caesar. In the last canto, that is canto 34 of the Inferno, who is in the mouth of Satan, chewed eternally at the bottom of hell, next to Judas in the middle, in this perverse representation of Christ and the two thieves, Brutus and Cassius on either side. So if Brutus and Cassius are there, because they oppose the divine empire, and for Dante the empire is divinely appointed and developed, then how in the world can Cato, who fought in the same war against Julius Caesar, how can he be saved? Because Dante decided he was fighting for different motives. He wasn't fighting against Caesar, he was fighting for the Roman Republic. And Dante, and this is a big subject to put into one sentence, and you don't need to believe me, I hope you will, Dante is a Republican. That doesn't mean he votes for Bob Dole, it means he's a Roman Republican, that his ideal for civic polity was the Roman Republic. And then Cato, as a champion of the Roman Republic, for Dante, just swept all other reasons to be put into hell aside. Cato is seen as a great man. He is not a suicide. He didn't commit suicide. He gave his life for liberty. It's another. Now those are words. I understand what a twisting thing that is to do. But that's what Dante makes us see. Cato is like Christ. He is not like Brutus and Cassius. He is not a suicide, indeed, but someone who has given his life for a higher purpose. The ninth book of Luke, and certainly if one reads it, shows how you might think of Cato in such a way. He has a kind of sublime Old Testament presence. He is almost like an Old Testament figure as we read him in Lucan. And indeed, as Dante represents him, he looks like an Old Testament presence. And I would argue he looks very specifically like one in particular. He looks like Moses. He is the lawgiver of the Romans. Indeed, in the eighth book of the Aeneid, verse 670, there is a wonderful line, which I can't prove this, but I'm sure myself that when Dante read it, his head came off. There is a line, it's on the shield of Aeneas, in which Virgil, who didn't very much like Cato of Utica, but supposedly was convinced by Horace to include him in his poem, so he put him on the shield of Aeneas, and it says, "And there is Cato giving them the laws." Now, in Latin, that line runs, "His Dantem jura catonem," and Cato giving them the laws. If you're Dante and you're an Italian, you look at that line and you see Cato's name, catonem, in the accusative, "His Dantem jura catonem." They're separated by a single word, inscribed in Virgil's text, or the names Dante Catone. You make Latin, Italian names out of ablatives. Dante Catone. And he sees inscribed in Virgil the promise somehow of the scene, as it were, a kind of a mystical moment where Virgil has a prophetic capacity, which indeed Virgil had, to see this meeting that now takes place between these two men who spend their time seeking liberty, Dante and Cato. The one who joins them is the one that Cato also figures. If you look at Cato, he has a function of Moses leading not the Israelites, but the good Republicans out of the desert. There's a desert scene in the ninth book of the Pharsalia, in which he triumphs for a while. He's going to die at the end of the epic, which is unfinished, so we don't get his death. And so Cato is presented as a kind of pagan version of Moses, leading his Israelites out of the desert toward salvation, which would be the salvation of the Republic, which won't happen. He's going to be a failed hero. But he is also, if he looks like Moses, in what he does, he is like Christ. And when Virgil describes Dante to Cato, introducing the two, he says, "He, Dante, seeks liberty, so dear a thing, as he who gives up his life for it well knows." Well, one who gave up his life for our liberty is Jesus Christ. And thus, Cato becomes, in my analysis of the scene, not only related to Moses, but related to Christ. He's seen as the pagan Christ, as it were. The pagan Moses as well as the pagan Christ, as the bridge between Dante and Cato is Christ. It is through Christ that Dante recognizes Cato. Now, if this is fairly dangerous and puzzling analysis of text, there's more evidence than one could bring to it. It also shows intrinsically, if we have an enormous pagan success in Cato, we have a pagan failure in Virgil. The last lines of the first canto of this poem show us Dante being girded by Virgil in the virtue of humility, which will be necessary for his ascent. And when that moment occurs, Virgil, the character in the poem, plucks a humble rush from the strand near the ocean surrounding the Mount of Purgatory and cinctures Dante with it, cinctures him in humility, under the direction of Cato. Cato tells Virgil to do this. From the earliest commentators in the 14th century, they all got the reference. That humble rush that is picked by Virgil to gird Dante comes from the sixth book of the Aeneid, where it's the golden bough, which is plucked under the instruction of the Sibyl, so that Aeneas can gain entrance to the underworld. Here, Dante, going to a better upper world, uses that Virgilian device, and when you first see it, you're suffused with a sense of the glory of Virgil's poem that can find place even in this Christian environment. So you think about it a little bit more. And I think this is what happens as you examine what happens to Virgil in Dante's poem. Yes, he is the world's greatest poet before Dante. Yes, he is the one who taught me everything I needed to know. And I've argued that it is Virgil who brings Dante back to a better understanding of Christianity, the rereading of Virgil, as paradoxical as that may seem. And all of those things are to be said positively about Virgil. But Dante, as though to prove to himself and to us that he doesn't need this pagan, Virgil failed. He led me to succeed, but he himself failed. And I'm always aware of that, Dante would seem to be saying. And if you look carefully at what I do with the golden bough, I transform it from a golden bough, which is very classical and paganizing, the value of gold, to a Christian one, to the humble plant, which as soon as it is plucked, grows back again. The golden bough does that too, but this humble plant reminds us of the great motif of the first canto of this poem, the resurrection of Jesus. It is a Christ-like plant. It's reborn again. It is humble. It is human. It is simple. It is not glorious. It is not pagan. And it's in that kind of confrontation between the world of the Aeneid, which is so important to Dante, and the world of the Christian scriptures, that the collision between these two is met. And Virgil has to lose as much as Dante, and we love him, and we witness him losing over and over again, culminating in this part of the poem, that simile that I referred to at the beginning of the sixth canto. Now, the second canto is very much the canto of two songs. We hear, after a prologue in which Dante and Virgil are looking at the shore, at the sea from the shore, and looking at the sunrise, we see a boat arrive, a ship filled with pilgrims from our world, this world, coming to purgatory to begin their purgation. We do a close-up on Cosella, this musician, a maker of violins, who was a friend of Dante, and either did or didn't actually set Dante's songs to music. I'm of the opinion that he probably didn't, in fact, but he does do so now on the spot in purgatory, and sings Dante's own ode to him, and everybody goes, "Isn't that beautiful?" And it is a very beautiful moment, except that something must be wrong with it, because Cato comes crashing down upon them and tells them they have no business doing anything like this. If we think about the first song, it's a song of David, the 113th psalm, the psalm of the Exodus. It is sung, it says in the text, entirely, from one end to the other. And thus we know what we're looking at. The early commentators knew too. Pietro di Dante, Dante's son, has it right. That means in our Bible, the Psalm 114 and 115. And the entirety of that is sung. 113 in the Latin Bible. 114, 115. And it's quite a long psalm. It's hard to understand how all of that could, but that's what it says in the text, and it says so very specifically. If one looks at medieval rubrics of Psalm 113, one sees that it is always divided into three parts. And what the three parts say are the Exodus, the vain idols of the people, the making of the golden calf, the backsliding of the Hebrews, and then an urge, urging us on to find God our true protector. So it's the continual story of the Israelites in the desert. It's a continual story of Genesis. You are given divine favor. You are given the opportunity to do something. You start doing it, and immediately you stop, and you backslide, and then are encouraged to continue so that the Hebrew people can move in its providential path through history. And this is exactly, I have argued, what happens in this canto. We have that movement. We have the Exodus accomplished. We have the completion of the Exodus. This is what everything is about. Christ, our Exodus. And we see the Exodus being accomplished now. They have left this world behind. They're coming to the afterworld, where they will finally be in eternity, loving God forever in absolute joy and absolute bliss. Nothing happier than that can ever happen, at least not in the world of this poem. And that's what we see, the foretaste of their first arrival at what will be their final destination. They have completed their Exodus. And the first thing they do, in my interpretation of the scene that follows, is build a golden calf. That is, they start loving something that they shouldn't be loving. At which point, who's supposed to come after the building of the creation of the golden calf and that big party in Exodus 32? Moses comes, right? Moses comes down the mountain. He's come with the tablets of the law. And he's met outside the camp by Joshua, says, "What's going on? What do I hear?" Joshua says, "There's a noise of war in the camp." Moses says, it's not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear. Moses isn't wrong. He knows what his colleagues are up to. They're having a party. Charlton, if you don't believe me, you can watch the biblical versions of it that have been done for the silver screen. It's quite a party. In any case, it's that moment which I claim lies behind this intervention on the part of Cato as Moses in this part of the poem. The moment, why is it so guilty? I mean, if that's right, and it has to be right, otherwise it's redundant. If Cato is wrong, why did Dante put it in? We have to do a very different kind of analysis if Cato is wrong. It'd be a strange thing to do. As I said before, he's dismissed from the poem after the first canto. There's no need for him to re-enter the poem unless they backslide. They do backslide, and here he comes again saying, get up the mountain. The words in which he does so are interesting. We'll get to them in a moment. But what's the problem here? There's a song sung by a maker of musical instruments to honor his friendship with the poet Dante Alighieri in the good old days in Florence. Well, you know, maybe you're not supposed to be thinking about the good old days in Florence anymore. But what about the song? The song is from a work of Dante called the Convivio, the Banquet, written on possibly Neoplatonizing ideas, in which Dante tells us that he turned aside from his love of Beatrice, the woman who has made this poem possible. We haven't spoken about Beatrice in these lectures. It's hard to think of how we've avoided it, but she is the center of the poem. We have a life of Beatrice given to us by the work of Dante. In his first work called The New Life, La Vita Nuova, he records his enamorment of her and his gradual understanding of what she really represents. What she really represents, he never puts it quite this overtly, but it becomes absolutely clear. What she represents is Jesus Christ. That is, if you're in the presence of Beatrice and you really understand what she represents to you, you will be a Christian. You will not love her the way poets love their girlfriends. You will love her the way you love St. Francis. And I think St. Francis is absolutely key to the making of the figure of Beatrice in Dante's imagination. So this figure of Beatrice, who is crucial to the first work, is discarded in the second work called the Convivio, when Dante says, she was wonderful, it was all right to love her when I was young, but now I'm mature and I've turned to more mature things. And I found another girlfriend, also not a carnal girlfriend, she is called the Lady Philosophy. She's modeled in part upon Cicero and upon Boethius, and certainly, I think, on some Neoplatonic texts. And so philosophy replaces Beatrice in Dante's life. Now, Dante says of her, I went to find silver, consolation, because Beatrice was dead, and I found gold, the true thing, the thing that I needed even more than I thought I needed Beatrice. Once you've said something like that, and then you write a poem, a long poem, an epic poem perhaps, in which Beatrice is a central figure, you've got a big problem on your hands. Even if no one else had read the poem, and the Convivio was not widely circulated, but perhaps more so than we think. But Dante knew it was out there, knew some people could find it, in which Beatrice is replaced. Well, you're going to need to spend some time canceling it. And that's what he does here. I think that is why we get this scene. When Cato comes rumbling down upon them, he is criticizing Dante, and not just the pilgrims, for re-engaging in this very difficult and dangerous activity of celebrating the death of Beatrice, as it were. Having turned his back on Beatrice, the one who made his life and his work possible for the Lady Philosophy, he needs, as I said before, to cancel that strain from his thought. And so that erasure is being carried on in public, in a strange way, in the second canto of the Inferno. Now, it's a little hard to say this, because everybody loves the scene. Most, 90-some-odd percent of the commentators think this is just a lovely moment in the poem, and Cato's a bit overzealous. Or Cato's wrong. There's nothing wrong with this. This is perfectly acceptable human behavior. Well, I don't think so. Listen to Cato's words. What are you doing, slothful spirits? What negligence, what staying is this? Run toward the mountain to divest yourselves of the slough the snake skin, that prevents you from seeing God. Get rid of your old selves. We're reminded of Paul, particularly in Colossians, asking us, in that particular text, Paul says it in other contexts as well, urging us to put off the old man and put on the new. That's the kind of thing that Cato was saying. Dante, you are worshiping your own idol, which is corrupt and wrong. It's not a trivial sin that you commit. It is a major one. Here you are, picked to come to this place, told you're going to come back to this place, and the first thing you do once you come to the place of joy is to celebrate your own divergence from the truth. What kind of person are you? It's a remarkable moment. Cato wins. Cato's right. We have to see it that way. Otherwise, the poem doesn't make sense. And we have to then try to establish the reasons for it. The canto concludes with a very pretty simile, which I think also hides this kind of iron wire that will choke you as it's pulled across your throat if you know how to read it. As when pecking at wheat or tares, doves gathered in their feeding, calm, not showing their usual pride, should something appear of which they are afraid, immediately cease their feeding. Just so, I saw this newly arrived band cease their singing and head for the mountain. The simile describes the reaction to the intervention by Cato. They go racing up the mountain like doves who have been doing what? Who have been at their feeding, pecking with their beaks at wheat or tares. The biblical text comes to mind. They don't discriminate. They'll eat wheat or tares. Dante has been eating tares, his own prior poetry. It's time to call that chaff and get on to the wheat. He should know better. He's been saved by Beatrice, and here he is behaving as though he hadn't. So that kind of backsliding, Dante as a latter-day Hebrew, backsliding, having been given the way, having been given every privilege, he's very, very harsh on himself as he deals with that. And here we see in this nexus of meaning that, in ways that are hard to understand, Cato and David, a Roman Republican and a Jewish sinner and singer of songs, become the models for Dante. And Dante identifies particularly with David in his humility, in his being the humble psalmist, as he calls him, in the 10th canto of Purgatory, in the 11th canto of Purgatory. Then he is also governed by that Cato, who represents the strength of the will directed toward God's purpose in some mysterious way, so that he is a Christian and will be saved. The text specifically says of Cato that in the great day his vestment shall be so bright. We can't hide from it. We can't allegorize Cato and get rid of him. He is a historical Cato, and he's going to heaven. It's an extraordinary thing, a very high-risk thing for Dante to have done, but what surprises you if Dante is taking great risks? The two songs of the second canto of the Purgatory are paradigmatic of the choices that face Dante and his readers. And thus do Cato, the Exodus, and Dante's previous poetry resolve themselves in this new poem that dares to present itself as an inspired Christian vision. Now, to conclude, what's wrong with an aesthetic reading of this poem? What's wrong with reading Dante's own joy in his past poetic accomplishment as being positive? I would say everything. It's a real problem, and this is not a statement without a polemical intention. I think we tend to, every generation tends to read Dante the way it likes to read, whatever Dante wants. And at this corner of the 20th century, what's left of it, we're not, at least most intellectuals, are not that big on religion. Not that enthusiastic about the theological vision of life. And we like Dante. And so we make Dante more like us than he would ever allow us to if he could answer us back. Well, he has left us a poem that I think does a pretty good job of answering back. But if we don't read it that way, it's not going to seem as though he does. Everything in this poem that makes sense for aesthetic reasons makes sense for Christian aesthetic reasons. Its sense of beauty is developed from not only the scriptures, but from the writings about the scripture. Dante cares about them. He wishes to be in accord with them. He's dramatized this, what's wrong with an aesthetic reading, by his own rejected poem, by showing us what's wrong with an aesthetic reading. We're given one. It's wrong, and it's to be jettisoned. It's not good enough. It's seen as the world of the old man, not of the new man. But if that's true, it nonetheless remains. And I think the one question that Dante can never quite answer, not logically, is if it's so important that your poem be theologically valid, that in fact that what you'd be perceived as doing is poeticizing theology, not theologizing poetry, which is what everyone else has done. You take poems and stick gods in them. That's theologizing poetry. Dante starts with a theological vision and poeticizes it. That's different. No one else had done that. Until Milton, no one else will do it. It's an extraordinary thing for him to have done, and a highly risky thing. But why? Why did he do it? I had a student many years ago in a class devoted to Boccaccio and Petrarch. And we were talking about the ways in which Boccaccio and Petrarch make their worlds work out in Christian ways, make their worlds available to Christian readers. And she asked the question, look, if they're both Christians, why is it so important for them to do their own writing? They had the scripture. And the other students in the class all began to laugh. And I said, don't you see? She's asked absolutely the necessary question, to which there is perhaps no answer. Why does Dante write a poem? Because he's a poet. Ends up being about the only answer there can be, I think. There is no logical justification for it. There is the scripture. We don't need Dante. But Dante chose to write a poem because he was a poet. And I think eventually the answer is a little bit like the answer we would have gotten if we'd asked Johann Sebastian Bach why he wrote music.